when you start in this job, you are a tillage boy. And then when you learn enough and you can communicate that, then we have a big ceremony where you become a tillage man. It's called a till mitzvah. And it's a special ceremony.
Ladies and gentlemen, farmers, ranchers, and distinguished guests, thank you for listening to the Farm for Profit podcast, where we discuss the latest ideas, methods, trends, and techniques available to help your farm achieve higher levels of farm profitability. The Farm for Profit podcast is co-hosted by Tanner Winterhoff, the Iowa Bankerman, and David Whitaker, the Iowa Land Guy, where in tandem, they will share their ideas and advice from industry experts. Thank you again for listening to the Farm for Profit podcast. Remember, if you aren't farming for profit, you won't be farming for long. And now, here's Tanner and David.
Welcome back to another Farm for Profit podcast. This is Tanner Winterhoff.
And this is David Whitaker.
Thanks, Mr. Auctioneer, for sitting in here and joining a banker to talk a little bit about farming and see if we can't bring our listeners a little bit of value this week during a Farm for Profit episode. So, Dave, for our listeners, if you're joining, the last episode you heard was a Farm for Fun show. This is a Farm for Profit. So we've got a What's Working in Ag segment, a general topic. We try to give a summarization at the end of this and then challenge you before we leave. But that's one way to keep it separate, Dave, between Farm for Profit and Farm for Fun.
You bet. And Tanner, if they have any suggestions, whether it's for the Fun Show or the Profit Show, they can send any request to us at farm4profitllc@gmail.com. Make sure to like, rate, review, and share all of our content. We love getting more listeners, so yeah, we greatly appreciate all the audience.
We've got a listener review right here from Ryan. He actually sent this one directly to Corey, one of our co-hosts. He said, "Hey, Corey, started listening to the podcast in the last couple of weeks. Just wanted to say I love the podcast and you guys are doing a great job." So thank you, Ryan. We really appreciate the kind words. Continue to share this with all your friends and family so that way we can continue to grow this network.
And Tanner, remember, I'm going to give a reminder to our listeners. For BW Fusion, they have an offer, opportunity to access their 365 program from last week's podcast. If you haven't listened in, go back and take a listen to that. You'll hear a good offer where you can get quite a deal by listening to our podcast.
You bet. Bodie gave us a really great message, shared a lot of information about the microbials in your soil. And just remember, if you go out to the website, you'll get all the details for that. But enough of announcements for today, Dave. Why don't we jump into our What's Working in Ag segment? What are we going to talk about?
We are going to talk with Ag Venture and germ testing. For those of you that don't know what that is, we're going to dig deep into that. And on the phone today, we have Brent Bilner. Brent, introduce yourself a little bit. Tell us what your tie to agriculture is.
Yeah, my name's Brent Bilner from Ag Venture, soon to be Simplot Grower Solutions. My tie to agriculture was growing up on a farm. Always enjoyed the agronomy side of it. Had plenty of work to do on the livestock side, so figured I enjoyed the agronomy side better. Got out of college and worked for a cooperative system for 8 seasons. And got an offer to come to Ag Venture. What brought me to Ag Venture was the uniqueness on how they focus on germination testing for their seed is what brought me there. And I currently manage the state of Iowa for Ag Venture in our Simplot division. And that's my tie to agriculture.
Terry, if you remember back years ago, before we started this podcast, we actually had one of our conferences in the Ag Venture building. Very generous to let them host our Farm for Profit conference there.
Yeah, we appreciate the longtime support, Brent. Maybe if you'd pass that on to the people up top, we would greatly appreciate that. But to start this off, why is it important to have an agronomy partner with you year-round when you're making decisions like this?
So a trusted advisor that would work with you year-round will be more tied into your farm, will understand your farming practices very well, and then they'll also have a look at multiple other farming operations around your area that they might find something that another farmer's doing that may work up for your farm as well.
So we talk about having an advisory team all the time. I'm sure our listeners are sick of us saying that terminology, but that's the truth. We need to have people around that can help share a little bit of advice. But what we're talking to you about today is germ testing. Can you explain what germ testing is?
Yep. Yep. So in on a bag of seed corn, it has a tag that has a warm shirt germ test done. And that is the only standard that is required to sell a bag of seed in the United States and on corn.
And you said warm, correct? You said the word warm.
Yep. So, yeah, what the warm germ is a test done somewhere between 68 and 72 degrees Fahrenheit, which is not a typical soil temperature when we're planting seed corn in Iowa.
So what's the difference? Do you test for cold then too, or just warm?
Yes. Yep. So the what we typically test for and what we feel is the best benefit to the grower would be the warm test, because we have to do that test. We do a cold test, a cold saturated test, and then a germination evaluation test after that.
And so all seed has to be tested, you're telling me, before it can be sold. What are we testing for? I get germination, but what specifically, I guess? I'm kind of curious.
In a warm germ, all it has to do is put a root or a shoot out, and that is the only thing required in a warm test. And any of the other germination tests, that's where, for us, we feel the germination evaluation test is extremely important.
So is there just a one seed per bag type test, or is it a percentage of the bag or a percentage of the bin when they're making all the bags, or how does that work?
So when they produce a lot of seed, so a lot of seed could be anywhere from 50 to 1,000 bags, depending on how the seed corn field turned out. But they'll take a sample out of that lot, and then they will run a warm test on it, because that's the only test that's required. And they will take 100 seeds out of that, lay them on a wet paper towel, roll them up, throw them in a growth chamber, let them sit for a period of time, could be 11 to 14 days, pull that paper towel out, and then evaluate all those seedlings. And if they do any kind of germination at all, so a root or a shoot, they'll count it as a germinated seed. They do the same thing with a cold test, but that is done somewhere around 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
So the standard for this, so obviously they're, you know, I'm thinking about banks being regulated. So when a bank is regulated from one to the next, we're all at the same standard. What is the standard then for a bag of corn to be approved?
Right. So currently, the only standard for a bag of seed corn to be approved is a 95% warm germination standard that can be plus or minus 2% on that germination standard.
Okay, so then what is AgVenture doing differently than the standard test to get us more information?
Right. Yep. So how we're approaching it is we do the warm test because we're federally mandated to do that. We do a cold test that a lot of companies will do, but they don't share that data. We have a standard on it, and we stay above a certain standard. Then we also do a saturated cold test, which is where you let the seedlings germinate for a little while. Then you give them a cold drink of water to try to simulate a spring rain. So that would be done also somewhere around that 50 degrees Fahrenheit. And then from there, from all those three tests, we look at the seeds that germinated and evaluate them for quality. So kind of my mentor and related to a lot of farmers that I deal with, I always relate it to a bunch of pigs. I'm a pig farmer from Northwest Iowa, is how I grew up. And if you had a lot of rump pigs, usually that lot of hogs, when they go to market, aren't very good. Same thing with your corn stand. If you have a lot of rump corn plants to start off your season, chances are you're not going to realize your full yield potential at the end of the year.
I think that makes sense. That's very relatable. So you obviously do this for your hybrids.
Yep.
But can anybody send their seed to you to have these tests done?
So we don't provide that service, but we highly encourage farmers to test their seed.
Okay.
Because I think they would be somewhat surprised on what they'd find in the bag.
So what are we getting from these results? What do we look at when we get the results back? What kind of decisions can we make?
So a lot of the decisions when we get our results back on our seed, we reject lots of seed because of this. I would suggest if a farmer got a lot with a coal score that was poor, that he tries to find a different lot of seed to plant, because we really can't hold off long enough on the seed to plant it into warm conditions, because by the time our soils warm up, it gets to be pretty late in the season, and then we lose quite a few growing days. Some things, if they're borderline on an okay score for cold tests or germ evaluation, you can plant those hybrids last, and it helps out a little bit.
Gotcha. So it helps with the decision-making process. Help me understand, we're farm for profit. So do you have any examples of you know, you know, your product's going to cost something, but how much, what's the juice worth in the squeeze here?
Right. Yeah. So some ag math on that is, we've planted out thousands of these side-by-sides, which is the same hybrid, same trait package in the same field with different lot quality standards, all of them which would be industry sellable, so all past the 95% warm germ. But we would have what we would deem as an excellent lot for us, a good lot, and then a lot that we wouldn't sell at all. And the yield difference between the excellent lot and the lot that we wouldn't sell at all, again, after 8 years of doing this and thousands of side-by-sides, is 16 bushel acre difference is what we're finding on some of these.
Well, that adds up. That adds up pretty quick. But okay, right. So imagine I'm a farmer. I've got my seed ordered for this year, and I've even got some of it in storage right now. You know, took early delivery or whatever it ends up being.
Yep.
Can I do a test like this from home? Is there a at home remedy that I could try if I wanted to experiment?
It would be. On the seed germination evaluation, it's pretty hard unless you got a really trained eye on how to evaluate them. So I would suggest sending them in to a seed lab. So Iowa State has one, Indiana Crop has one, Illinois has one, Minnesota has one. There's a lot of seed testing labs out there. And I think the cost on it is around $25 to have your seed sampled, and it'll be the best money a farmer could spend.
I gotcha.
Is knowing what his actual cold test scores are and germination evaluation is.
Well, that's great for our listeners to think about that. Maybe another way to get you another 16 bushel per acre, something you might not have thought about. I know I hadn't thought about it before. Well,
that's a good point, Dave. This kind of reminds me of what Bodie said, and that when you open the bag, we lose potential. This could be one of those things to check to make sure that we're not losing potential by planting bad seed.
Yeah, pertinent negative. Yep. So, Brent, is there any other suggestions you have to share with our listeners before we wrap up here?
I would say, I mean, those trusted advisors are really, really important for you guys for farmers to work with, because of these types of things, and help work through some of these processes. But I would really really suggest working with a company that puts an emphasis on testing their seed and having a standard on their seed test beyond the warm test.
I think that's great advice. And listeners, that's our What's Working in Ag segment today. We want to thank Brent Vilner from AgVenture and soon to be Simplot Grower Solutions for talking about what germ testing actually is. So we're going to take the hybrids that we've got picked out. Maybe we order it through them. Either way, we want the information to know if we've got a good lot of seed, and then possibly make our hybrid selections based upon the temperature of the soil that it's going to best get started in. So kind of a quick little hit there, maybe a tip that's going to help boost your bottom line. And Brent, like I said, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing your information.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
All right, Dave, let's roll into our general topic. So our first thing we're going to talk about is getting that planner ready, potentially, and then learning what kind of new technology is available around the planter itself, the piece of equipment. We're not talking about necessarily a task of doing it. We're going to get into what the advancements are there. So what could farmers be doing in a decision to make regarding their planter that helps them make some more money, helps them make a little bit more profitable, Dave?
Boy, I bet there's all kinds of things that they could, you know, from changing out different spacing population to just make sure tubes are clean and kinds of stuff. And Tanner, there's a number of things that we could definitely do with this.
Yes, we've got a guest with us today. We want to thank Adam Gittins for joining us. Adam, just a quick introduction for you. You developed a love for agriculture at an early age. You went to Iowa State where you got your Bachelor's of Science degree in ag business. You stayed in the area then and worked for Ag Leader Technology in Ames, Iowa for a while. You provided assistance with hardware and software to dealers and then got into the GPS and guidance side as a specialist. But most importantly, in the fall of 2005, you joined the Precision Ag team at HTS Ag, and that's why we have you here today. You've relocated back near the family farm with you and your wife, Melissa, and now you're the general manager of HTS Ag, and most importantly, here on the Farm for Profit podcast to help share with us a little bit of insight on what we can do to these planters to help us get a better ROI. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start off. We're here at the end of February. Maybe some of our guys haven't even got the old planter out of the shed to start working on it and are daydreaming about the spring ahead of us. What's the coolest thing in your mind that is advanced in planters from 2020 to 2021?
Well, guys, the thing that is the buzzword in the industry right now is high-speed planting. That's the thing everybody's talking about. It's the thing everybody thinks they want to do, whether they actually do or not. And I guess we can kind of dive into that topic a little bit and break down the pieces of that technology and talk about how it actually makes a profit, because there's no point in investing in a high-speed planter if you're not going to see a return on that investment.
You like that, Dave? Should we break it down?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I know I've heard that buzzword.
All right, go ahead, Adam. Start away.
Well, first and foremost, if you do not have hydraulic downforce on your planter, I don't care what brand, make, model, or manufacturer we're talking about, you do not have a high-speed planter. Anybody that thinks that you can get by with air on a high-speed planter is just absolutely kidding themselves, because I had a customer describe it to me this way. He was running a competitive system to what we sell, and he said, you know, when I take off across the field and I get up to 10 miles an hour, my planter, it's kind of like a boat coming up the plane as I go through the field, and until the airbags catch up with it and push down a little harder and drive it back into the ground. And I asked him, what do you suppose is happening during those 10, 12, 15 seconds while you're waiting for your airbags to catch up and all of that distance that you covered? And he said, oh, I suppose I'm probably not planting at the right depth, am I? I said, no, you're not.
Yeah.
And so the real cornerstone to me is that hydraulic downforce system. And our system has active uplift as well, which I think is important because we get into those really soft areas of the field. And not only do we need to be able to push down hard enough to maintain depth, but sometimes those row units are too heavy. And in order to prevent the sidewall compaction, we actually want to be able to lift up a little bit on that unit.
Well, I'm glad that you clarified that, because I kind of had a look of question on my face as to what uplift was. I had never heard that before, but it makes complete sense. If you want a constant seed depth, you have to be able to go both ways.
Yeah. I mean, what we want to do is just simply offset the weight of the row unit. You know, the row unit itself can weigh a few hundred pounds. And in really soft soils, that's too much. We're actually creating compaction. So we can just gently lift up on that row unit. No, we're not going to pick it up out of the ground, although we probably could if we really wanted to. The concept there is that instead of that row unit going across the field weighing X amount of pounds, and an even bigger thing, when you're talking about a box planter instead of a bulk fill, how much do you suppose that row unit weighs when the box is clear full of corn versus when it's almost empty? And so when that box is clear full, we can actually compensate and lift that just a little bit so that we don't have that extra compaction going across the field.
So you're talking soil compaction all day long on this. And so to be uplift, do we have to have hydraulic to be an uplift, or is there different types of uplift as well?
So you can do it mechanically with springs. You can do it with airbags. But when we're back to the starting point here of high-speed planting, we really need to be hydraulic, because hydraulic, we're taking 200 readings per second, and we're able to adjust very, very rapidly with hydraulics. Nothing else on the market can come close to that.
Okay, so that helps a lot, and that's what you have to be a high-speed planner. I mean, it really makes a high-speed planner effective. But what are the advantages of going high speed? Why are guys wanting to transfer, guys and gals, wanting to transition into a high speed planner?
So I took a real hard look at this as I ran Ag Leader's prototype of this last year and beta tested that for them. The high speed planting has several benefits. One is we actually do a better job with the planter, because not only are we able to singulate that seed very, very well coming out of the meter, but we have a delivery mechanism all the way down the seed tube. So we're maintaining that perfect spacing, even if you're not running faster. But because we have that extra mechanical delivery and we're not just depending on gravity to drop the seed, that gives us the ability to speed it up and not lose any precision or accuracy of that. So hydraulic downforce is the cornerstone that gets us the proper depth. But then we go to an electric meter and a delivery system down the seed tube, so that we're placing that seed evenly and accurately right at the ground, and we're able to drop that at the same speed as what we're transferring from.
So, Adam, are there like row clutches on each row then? You're talking exact spacing. Help me understand mechanically how a high-speed planner is doing that, but one that's not high-speed isn't. So one that's not high-speed is just gravity dropping the seed and hoping we hit the right spot, correct?
Yeah, and so if we think back to maybe a finger pickup meter, the accuracy of the finger pickup meter is not quite as good as some of the vac meters that are on the market. And then the high-speed vac meter goes even one step farther. So we've got the best of the best of the vac meter, but instead of dropping that seed 2 feet and hoping that it lands in the same method that we dropped it, we're actually running a conveyor belt down the seed tube all the way to the ground, and we're dropping it, you know, less than an inch. It's getting released just right at the ground, and it's actually turning backwards a little bit so that it's released at the speed of travel that we're moving forward. So that's where we can run with the Ag Leader system up to 12 miles per hour and still maintain that perfect spacing as we go across the field.
So speed is obviously one of the advantages. I mean, you don't have to necessarily be as wide, but you can go faster and cover more acres. Is that the only advantage to high speed, or is that singulation and exactness of the seed that big of a deal?
So there's some of both. With these meters, now every meter is individually driven by an electric motor. That gives us a ton of advantages in and of itself. One of the tests that we ran last year on my own farm was a side-by-side comparison of turn compensation. So think about the track around your high school football field. We all know that the outside lane is longer than the inside lane.
Right.
As you go around the curve, a 12-row planter is, give or take, the same width as that track. So if you go around that curve and you are dropping the same amount of seeds out of each meter, we overpopulated on the inside and or underpopulated on the outside of that curve. So we did a side-by-side trial, a replicated strip trial, of comparing turn compensation on versus turn compensation off on my planter, which is a 12 row. And we were able to show just a little bit over 12 bushels per acre difference just in the turn compensation.
Wow. That's kind
now,
of a big
Now add
deal.
That with the exactness that we were talking about from the singulation and spacing, and you've got another benefit there. But yeah, speeding up the planter, we all know what the weather's been doing the last couple of years. Last year, we had a great window to do it in, but everybody thinks back to 2019. And if you remember the spring of 2019 and trying to get that crop planted, I finished up on the 1st of June and just felt like I was beating my head against the wall. We had hours each day to plant instead of days in between rainstorms. It would dry up enough by maybe 3 in the afternoon, and it'd be raining again by 5 or 6. So being able to get that seed in timely in the short windows that we had made a big difference.
So Tanner, you know, we've been talking with all kinds of people of ways to be more profitable, and everybody's got their niche for an extra 10 bushel an acre or so.
Right. That's how we're going to get to 600.
I'm wondering, you know how we talked about being the pharmacist and one thing might counteract another. I'm wondering, do these high-speed planners, as they're going through, and maybe we have new coating on the seed or we have something that we've done with the seed to make us more money, does this harm the seed at all going through faster or through all the clutches through? I picture the seed tumbling through and it's either, it needs to be deeper, it needs to be less deep, it needs to be faster, quicker, air pushing it through. Does that have a deficit on one side, but then maybe in population, you know, a positive on the other side?
I'm glad you brought that up and you asked that, because it's actually just the opposite. We actually handle the seed much more gently than what you would with the old meters. We split a lot less seeds, and especially in soybeans, because we are handing the seed is never dropped. We're using a brush and handing it off from the vac plate into a conveyor belt, and then the conveyor belt takes the seed all the way to the ground. So it doesn't bounce, it doesn't roll, and it doesn't have those, abrasive qualities you might see of sliding against the tube on the way down or dropping and cracking possibly.
So it could be even better.
Could be.
That's good.
So we've talked about the downforce. We've talked about the ability to go faster. We've talked about your turning adjustment, you know, to make sure that the population is consistent from the inside row to the outside row. One of the other buzzword topics that we always hear about is variable rate. So what advancements in planting have come along to go with these VRT prescriptions that we keep hearing about?
Well, there's a lot of schools of thought out there around variable rate planting, and I'll certainly share my views and opinions on it.
Yeah.
But keep in mind that it's simply that. It's one man's opinion. I have in my own operation seen probably a larger benefit from variable rate soybeans than I have from corn. And simply because I farm in Southwest Iowa, where we have some pretty severe rolling terrain. We've got some F slopes over here. That's a 20 to 30% grade. And so in those steeper hills, the thinner soils, I actually want to increase my population so that I can force a little more height out of the soybeans. And what I have found out is that with this planter, we did a population trial with this planter on some good ground, on some bottom ground. We dropped the population all the way back to 80,000 seeds per acre.
Wow.
And at 80,000 versus the 120,000 and 160,000 strips that we put in, half the seed, we had a lot less seed cost. And when you're talking Xtend beans or Enlist beans and treated seed and all of the things that go with it, the seed cost has gotten almost out of hand with soybeans. So we're able to see some significant savings in the seed cost, but then also the highest yielding soybeans in that strip tile that we did were 80,000. We actually had a pretty fair yield boost from that.
Nice. So there are a lot of advancements in the variable rate technology when it comes to planting also. All these advancements, Adam, in my mind, means there's just more stuff that could go wrong with the planter. So is the service side keeping up with the advancements of the technology and the equipment? Is there anything new on the service side for planters?
You know, from our perspective, we've built our business off of being a service-focused company. And we really view it as anything can break. Electronics are certainly well-tested through AgLeader. And that's one of the things that I play a role in, is helping test the product before they go to the field. So we feel like we've got a very robust product when it does go to the field. And on the odd chance that something goes wrong, something breaks, we've got very knowledgeable and trained staff that we can dispatch out along with parts to be able to get that planter up and going. So no different than a bearing going out, a chain breaking. What we're finding is we're eliminating so many of those mechanical parts that it is more than offsetting the potential downside from the electronics is more than offsetting the potential mechanical downsides of having all the moving parts.
So I'm imagining like the doctor on call, where, you know, I know that I've got an ear infection because I've had an ear infection 4 or 5 times, and I can now just call the doctor and ask them for him to fill me a prescription. Is there anything like that with diagnosing planter issues? You know, is anybody doing something like that?
Yeah, and even better than that. So what we can do is actually log remotely into the display in the cab and see it as if we're sitting in front of it. I can do that from my home, from my truck, if I pull off to the side of the road. We utilize an app that allows us to hook right up to your smartphone And so you can point your video camera on your phone at whatever you're having a problem with. And I have that one-way video chat available to me so that I can see what you're seeing and help diagnose the issue and get you up and going.
That's a must anymore, Tanner. I mean, even in my or your worlds, I remote into my guys' computers all the time because they just, the age demographic is different and the young guys know it a lot and or think they do. And the older guys struggle with it a little more and maybe don't want to be as click happy on the.
Sure. That's the point of having an expert. And I guess I had never thought the technology that's in the cab with a farmer right now is probably just as much as sitting in front of us on a computer. Yeah. So why wouldn't you be able to remote in? Yeah, I'm glad you shared that with us, Adam. I think that is extreme. I mean, that should be extremely valuable to our listeners.
Yeah, I'm thinking of all the advancements that, you know, planters have come from where it was individual box to wound three bushel boxes to center fill to got rid of the markers to hydraulic down pressure. Is there a certain soil type that a high-speed planter does not work in, you know, like, did they have to do fall tillage prior to that? Or, you know, I'm guessing the different soil types will make a difference in how that planter goes through the field.
Well, it certainly does. But my experience with it has been that if you have the right equipment on the planter and the cornerstones being hydraulic downforce and electric drives, we're able to actually compensate for an awful lot of issues out there. And that gives us the ability to maybe not be so focused on what widget or gadget is out there on the planter that helps cover up a problem that might be created. We actually solve the problem on the go by having that technology there. So I ran, you know, 1200 plus acres of no-till. We ran some tillage. We've been in all kinds of soil types and the high-speed planter just seemed to work really, really well. Speed did not really have any impact on that versus what the planter would do otherwise, other than it took a whole bunch more horsepower to be able to pull that planter.
So is there anything that our listeners, if they want to upgrade and they're going to upgrade to a high-speed planter, I'm thinking there's some already out that are even hitting the auction world. When you talk about drives and motors, is there anything specific? I'm guessing there's a lot to look at if they're buying something on the used market or secondhand market or bought it from their neighbor or retired. Do you have a checklist of a couple things to look at for our listeners if they were to, whether it's an auction or go to a show and, you know, that they need to check on that planter?
Sure. If you're looking at a used planter and especially, regardless of whether it's a high-speed planter or not, I guess the same concepts would apply. You want to know the age of the machine. You want to know how many acres it's been through. And specifically what we want to look at then on the high-speed planters, we want to look at wiring harnesses. We want to look at all of the same wear items. But by knowing how many acres it's been through, any of the manufacturers, Agleader included, would have a published list of replacement parts, depending on the amount of acres or the amount of hours that each of those rows have ran. So not a lot different than, you know, replacing your TruVs or anything else on the planter. You just got to look at how many acres the planter's been through.
Well, that's good. Now, we've been talking a lot about the technology and the advancements on the market that our listeners can take advantage of. Say we're not in a spot to where we can upgrade this year. What are some key things that we should look at on our existing planter to make sure things go at least as smooth as they can this spring?
You know, one of the things that I often tell guys, having worked with the hydraulic downforce systems now since 2012, so I've got a lot of years worth of data on hydraulic downforce specifically. In my observations across a bunch of data, my own and others, you have less penalty for too much downforce than you do not enough downforce. So if you want to relate this even back to your spring planter and you're trying to figure out what to set the springs to, I would tell you set them a little heavier. Hmm. We had an instance, if we have time for a quick story.
Yeah.
I pulled in on a nice piece of river bottom along Highway 59 and planted this. It had been field cultivated. This was one of possibly the best field conditions I've ever been in. You walked out in there, you would think, you know, it's an absolute perfect seed bed. It was really smooth. It was really mellow, nice and soft as we're rolling across this. And we actually noticed, because of the resolution of these sensors on the planter, we noticed that as we were going across the field, we could start to see stripes in the map at an angle. And it turned out it was the angle that it was field cultivated at. And what had happened was the wings of the field cultivator, the hydraulic cylinders had gotten out of phase with the center of it. And so the wings were not going in as deep as the center. And we were creating underneath of that surface a much different seed bed that the hydraulic downforce system was actually compensating for.
Hmm. Huh. Well, that's the advantage of it too. And I know when I've talked to some of my customers, you know, they're looking to make sure that the bushings aren't worn out. They want to make sure that there's not a lot of play in those parallel arms. I know we'll come back to you listeners with some more quick things to check on that existing equipment. But one other thing before I ask you to kind of wrap up for us, Adam, is just the future. What the future looks like. I know we've all seen this autonomous planner, but whether we believe that's going to work or not, what do you see the future of planners looking like?
Well, I think we've started down that path just a little bit. My vision of the future with technology and agriculture is that we're going to see the equipment become smaller and we're going to see more things interconnected. Some have used the term swarms. So if you think of a bunch of devices out in the field doing a task, maybe it's a bunch of field robots that could go out and weed a field. Maybe it's a bunch of drones that could go out and spray a field. Or maybe it's even something simpler than that. Right now, today, we've got interconnectivity between planters. So if you want to put two planters in the field, we can make them talk to each other.
Right.
The one knows where the other's been. And I think we'll see that trend continue where you could have multiple planters. One of the things I think will be a stepping stone before we totally get out of the planter is maybe I go to the field with one planter and I have a second automated planter that's in the same field with me that I'm just kind of keeping an eye on from the tractor that I'm running, and I'm running two planters from one cab.
I could see that. That's a really good observation. I could see that. We already have some of that technology that we learned through Smart Ag. Oh, probably been a year ago since we had that podcast, Dave, of the grain cart that is operated by the combine operator. So the combine mm-hmm. operator is in the field and can call the cart when he wants it and send it back to the truck when he doesn't. So I think you could see technology like that.
Just a way to ease into that technology until everybody's comfortable with it.
Well, before we send you off, Adam, is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Oh, just want to thank you guys for having me on. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about planters and technology and all the great ways that we can help out and make technology make things more profitable.
So as we get ready to send you out, if anybody does have a question for you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
You bet. You can find us on all of the social media platforms, or you can simply give us a call at 800-741-3305.
Perfect. Well, thank you I know we rushed right through this and appreciate your time, but thank you for joining us today. And maybe we'll have you back some time to dig a little bit deeper.
I'd sure appreciate it, guys. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, let's roll right into our next segment, Dave. Kind of a unique episode that we've got. So yeah, we're going to roll right into the next unique topic that we have on this pre-spring future of all things equipment.
You bet. Tanner, we've already talked about germ testing. We talked about planters. Now let's talk about the tillage side of the world. So on the phone, we got the tillage man, Sam Paulson out of Minnesota, and he's the regional tillage specialist for Deere, and he's kind of covers the area of the north central area, Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota primarily. Welcome. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be here.
And so you've been with Deere for over 8 years now.
Yeah, I've been with Deere for almost 10. I've been with tillage for a little over 8, so probably longer than a guy wants to be with a product line. But I love tillage, man. So
and so you're the tillage man. How'd you come up with how'd you get that title?
It's a funny story. When you start in this job, you are a tillage boy. And then when you learn enough and you can communicate that, then we have a big ceremony where you become a tillage man. It's called a till mitzvah. And it's a special ceremony. No, I think honestly, I don't really know. I don't remember where the tillage man Sam thing started. It could have been a YouTube cameo or something. But all of a sudden, people just started calling me that when I'd show up on farms. And they saw me on YouTube if I was on the Millennial Farmer video or something, and all of a sudden people started referring to me as Tillage Man Sam, and I was like, "Well, wow, people." I mean, this—that's where I started to realize that social media is powerful and it has quite an audience, especially sometimes regionally. So,
well, that's how I found you. I found you on TikTok and Instagram, and I'm pretty sure I just found the 30-second prelude to this podcast. I always try to grab a little bit out and put it at the beginning of every show, and I have people are going to wonder what the hell you're even talking about when you talk about being a tillage boy and growing up to become the tillage man.
Would you say tillagist?
Yeah. No, I think that's perfect. But the reason we have you here is because you're an expert on tillage, and that's the second phase of our topic for today. You grew up on a farm in southern Minnesota, so you also understand how it directly impacts the farmer and why some of these tillage decisions are necessary. I know that we'll probably get a little bit of back and forth on our social media platform because of the no-till versus minimum till versus strip till versus let's turn it black and get her to heat up nice and quick. That's not what we're getting into today. We want the advancements in technology on tillage. So what do you think is the most exciting thing, Sam, in your line of work that has happened to tillage in the last most recent time?
Oh, I would say, I think the most exciting thing is just how, and I think the whole agriculture, and I say the crop care cycle, but when I say that, it's when you're talking the planting phase, the spraying phase. And if you look at the advancements in technology that we have there, it's just over the last 3, 4, 5 years have been tremendous. And tillage isn't being left behind there. I mean, every part of the crop cycle is becoming more precise and tillage isn't being left behind at all. So, we've had a technology for several years called TruSet. And originally, you know, and getting guys into that, it's just on a very base level in field adjustments. And then we can have presets. But just from that basic level of just simple in field adjustments, we can go, we can get the documentation from those recorded layers and tie that back to, you know, how harvest went. And then we can also take that data and turn it into a prescription. So we can use a soil map. We can use a yield map, but we can build a prescription for our tillage pass so that we are extremely precise and that tillage tool is doing the work for of the adjustment for you.
Really, we're writing a prescription for tillage. We're talking about the task that historically has been you just threw whoever you could get in the spring into the machine to run it, and now we're writing a prescription. Why is this important?
Well, and it's funny because when I kind of started in this role being a regional rep, and I went to spring clinics and I started to mention, or I'd even bring up prescription tillage. I think it felt like people would be like, okay, it's just tillage. But if you look at all the other advancements in the technology field, you know, even just going back to simple auto track and how long that took to catch on, or prescription seeding, those things take a while to catch on. So I think one of my biggest roles is just to get people on that level so that we're, so they're bought in to the idea of more precision tillage.
Gotcha. So you talked about TruSet technology, and we just talked with on the planting side about high speed technology in terms of planting is one of the newest features. Is there a high speed feature with tillage?
Yeah. If you look at really the last three kind of, I would call them major product launches for John Deere, which was the 2230 field cultivator, the 2680H high speed disc, and then the 2660 VT variable tillage tool. All those tillage tools had a big focus on high speed tillage. And all of those have an, you know, recommended operating range that hits the double digits, whether it's 7 to 10 miles an hour or with the 2680H 10 to 14 miles an hour. And that's the biggest shift that I've been seeing in, you know, the tillage market has been more so speed versus actual, you know, getting wider and wider and wider implements.
So that just kind of blows my mind because, you know, I grew up running tillage at, you know, 4.5 to 6.5 mile an hour. And that was, you know, limiting factor based upon the technology that was behind the tractor and, of course, the horsepower. So I'm assuming that if you want to go that fast, it takes a pretty big horse to sit in front of that tillage tool, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, if you look at like my family farm, we have a 2230 field cultivator and we had upgraded from, I believe it was a 1988 model 960 field cultivator. Yeah. And that was a big jump for us. So we couldn't pull that 960 faster than about 4.5 miles an hour or all the shanks were tripping back. And then we go to a 2230 and I had a heck of a time just coaching my dad to go 9 miles an hour because the tool works better at 9 miles an hour, especially with a rolling basket on the back and the chaos that basket creates to knock out clods and really, mm-hmm. you know, create a really nice seed bed. It does a better job at 9 miles an hour than it does at 6. So that took a lot of coaching for us, and we're only running 250 acres. So, and 7290 is the horse in front of that. So we don't necessarily need to have a big tractor, but it does shift that horsepower per foot range up to get that higher speed.
So you talked about rolling baskets. As an auctioneer, I see this on the back of some. There's always a debate. Do you do a 5-bar harrow, a 4-bar harrow, a roller basket, a couple different technologies there. Do you have a preference?
Well, being that we bought a unit with a rolling basket, and one of the biggest reasons we bought that 2230 was the rolling basket, I have a personal preference on that's the way to go. Now, I've had guys tell me that bought a machine with, like, say, a 4-bar coil tine harrow. They're not looking to create a very fine, you know, soil profile or seed bed, just because they're afraid if they don't get out there with a planter right away that it's going to kind of crust over
right.
and create some problems that way. So I don't think, and this is with tillage across the board, is it's never a one size fits all solution. I don't think everybody needs to be doing something, and I don't recommend tillage practices on anyone. I want somebody to tell me what they want a tillage tool to do, and then I'll tell you how to do it.
Well, that's a nice approach. I mean, that's kind of, I feel that's kind of the way our listeners work, is we put out general suggestions and inform them of letting them know that this is available, and then they can go and do the research and make a decision on their own. But one of the latest TikToks that I came across of yours, might not have been your most recent put out, is a double rolling basket. Can you explain why we might have a double rolling basket set up?
Well, and so we only have one tillage tool that has that double rolling basket set up, and that's the 2660 BT. And the reason that it's a double rolling basket, and not saying this is the only reason to have a double rolling basket, but the reason that tool has a double is because those two baskets are doing two different jobs.
Okay.
And so we can make baskets two different jobs, and we can configure tools with different baskets, you know, like a flat bar versus a round bar. They do a little bit of a different, you know, job. I think a flat bar, it leaves the soil surface a little bit looser and finer. And a rolling basket that's a round bar, you know, does a little bit more firming of the seed bed. So kind of depends on what you're looking for. But on the 2660 VT, that front basket is a knife edge, and it's in a reverse orientation so that that knife edge blade hits the ground flat and creates a rumbling effect. So I call that basket the rumbler. And then the back basket is your traditional crumbler basket that breaks up clods and kind of levels off the surface. So the tag team of the rumbler and the crumbler, to give you that perfect seed bed, is kind of a kitschy bit that I thought was funny, but, like Bebop and Rocksteady from the Ninja Turtles.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So that's the reason that that tool is configured that way. Now there's been, you know, we have guys that order a field cultivator with a rolling basket and then get a, you know, a rear hitch and pull another rolling basket behind it. So they just want that extra clod breakage, that really nice, you know, surface profile. So there's a few different reasons to do it, but.
Well, Tanner, that makes me think of what we always go back to, and that is trusted advisor. I did not even put a thought to that a flat bar and a round bar would do something different. One to loosen the soil, one to do that. So I just learned something.
Yeah.
I'm sure some of our listeners just learned something just from that one question. I would have thought a roller basket was a roller basket was a roller basket. So that is good information. Everybody needs a trusted advisor. So maybe you need Sam here as your tillage man to be the advisor and part of your team. So even down to the small things like that, I wouldn't have thought that.
So when you talked about TruSet, Sam, now how accurate can you get going through the field? I mean, yeah, you can make infield adjustments, but how much has technology advanced in being specific there?
Yeah, and I'd say with TruSet in its current form, you know, a little bit of that accuracy is left up to you. There is some field calibration to make sure it's really dialed in. But the level of adjustment that you have, if we're talking depth control, we're down to a tenth of an inch. So
wow.
I don't see a lot of guys making tenth of an inch adjustments necessarily. Some of that like 0.2, 0.3 is pretty common, or half an inch at a time. But man, there's nothing cooler than a demo when you go out and you've got a guy that's a little skeptical on TruSet, and then you take him out and you show him just the difference, especially with a tool like, you know, the 2660 VT or the 2230. You drop it down a half an inch and you just feel that. And so, and that whole, you know, the proof is in the pudding type of thing. You show a guy the difference that an inch makes on, you know, their depth as far as how much horsepower, how much power it's taking that tractor to pull, you know, that all ties back into, you know, the efficiency of your tillage operation.
So then that's what's available now. Where, since you're right in it every day, where do you see the future of tillage going? What's something exciting that you know is potentially going to happen in the future or as it relates to tillage?
Well, and I think the technology is going to continue to grow. And this is something that John Deere has really been a leader on in the tillage world, is the precision side. And we call that automation. So in the automation phase, you know, that's one thing we've been a leader in for several years. We've been the benchmark there. And so we're just going to continue to grow upon the technology that we already have, and continue to make it more precise and continue to give you more tools from our end to make sure that, you know, we can show you that the precision side of tillage is key to make your operation as efficient and profitable as possible.
As we look at the advancements of technology to planting, there's companies out there like Sabanto that's working on having an autonomous planter with no driver, driverless planter, basically. So on the tillage side of things, do you see autonomous tillage coming down the pipeline? And if so, what do you think that looks like?
Yeah, and I think that's the direction. I mean, I think that's really the end goal when you're talking automation, to get to the level of automation. I think the real trick is, I think the technology is there to do this. The challenge is just getting our producers on board with the idea, I think. So we can continue to work on the technology, but if the market's not ready for it, then we're going to, you know, that's going to be a challenge for us. So I think when you're working towards that level, my job in this whole situation is to just get guys on board with what we have currently, you know, for precision tillage.
That makes a lot of sense. We had a guest, Chuck Weldon, on before, and he mentioned that in his lifetime, he won't ever, you know, in his farming career, he won't, because he just knows time horizon, his desires. So I could see that being a battle for you, Sam.
You think of like CDs, MP3s, Laserdisc, if you remember that, cassette tapes, etc. I remember when like Laserdisc came out and everybody needed, and then Blu-ray players came out and everybody had to have Blu-ray. And it was like, there was a, you know, Sony had their horse in the race and everybody had their horse and it was who was going to win it. And then all of a sudden Netflix came around and just trumped them all. Bringing that new technology out at the right time when people are ready for it. I think some of that stuff happened prematurely, or they came to market prior to it being ready, and it just didn't take, even though it was great technology. So probably the same with this. Even if we're ready for being autonomous, like you said, everybody's got to be on board.
So Sam, we're talking a lot about the technology that's available, and I know that not every one of our listeners can go out there and order themselves a new field cultivator. So what, in your experience, is something that they can do to the tillage equipment sitting in their shed to get it ready for spring? What are maybe some key things that they could look out for?
Well, and I think there's some really obvious things, you know, when you're talking about the high wear parts, if it's sweeps or disc blades, stuff like that. That's all pretty basic level stuff that everybody looks at. I think from my standpoint, one thing that I think on current tools that have some wear on them that you got to look at is on the preventative maintenance side. So if you're looking at a field cultivator, and I think this is a general practice for a lot of guys, but you know, checking pivot bolts and checking the pivots on shanks, mm-hmm. making sure that those aren't loose or that there's nothing that's, you know, my word is warbled out. But those are the things that can throw a wrench in your tillage operation, you know, and put you down in the field. And so that's where guys get really frustrated, is when they want to go and they can't. It's easy to spot a shank or a sweep that's worn. It's not easy to spot something like that. So as far as, you know, a gang disc with bearings, stuff like that, or whether it's a, you know, the high speed disc with the rubber torsion elements that are used for suspension, making sure those clamps are tight, making sure all your bolt tight, and making sure that your shanks are going to hold up through the spring to make sure you're not down in the field, because efficiency and productivity is the name of the game when we're talking spring tillage.
That's a good piece of advice. It's kind of those things that maybe aren't top of mind and maybe aren't obvious, but is going to save you time when we get to the season. They're therefore helping us out on our ROI, Dave.
So, Sam, we're always talking profitability. You know, it costs a lot for a new field cultivator, I would assume. What have you seen any trials that using a newer, other than speed, save time, time's money, other than time, is there any advantage for my guy to upgrade his field cultivator now to a newer technology?
Yeah, a lot of the testing that we've done has been kind of, especially with spring tillage, has been based off of the readings that you get from a newer planter. and just how good the seed bed is, it's all based on how the planter can get through there. So if we look at numbers like singulation and ride quality, and the difference between, you know, whether it's a different field cultivator or an older John Deere field cultivator compared to like a 2230, or if you're looking at a 2660 VT, that's where the proof is really, that's where it hits a guy, you know, square in the jaw, is when they can see the difference between maybe their old machine and then a new demo unit or something like that. Those have been the most effective demos by far. And just looking at, you know, they went from 96 to 99 on singulation, and they're like, wow, that's, there it is.
Yeah, Adam just shared with us a story about how the one of the field cultivator wings was not synced, and they could see based upon the down pressure map the difference that it made just in the machine itself not being set properly. So I could see where the extra automation that you've been talking about is going to pay big dividends. So I'm going to give you a question to think about before answering. And we ask all of our guests, try to ask all of our guests, is amongst all the farmers that you've networked with and work with, what is a common trait you think that makes them the most successful? But while you're thinking about that, is there anything else that comes across your mind that you'd like to share with us about tillage before we close out?
Yeah, interesting question. I mean, I would say as far as, you know, you're talking, there is a group of farmers and you recognize them pretty quickly when you're on a territory. There's certain guys that people look to make their tillage decisions, right? And that's because tillage is like hyper-regional. And that's why I have a job that is, you know, in the field, is because to get the right feedback back to the factory, to be that voice of the customer, you got to be on the ground. You got to be in that region, because I think tillage is almost like like someone's accent. Like there's waitresses at diners that someone talks to them and they can peg where you're from. I feel like I'm about at the point where if somebody tells me what they're doing for tillage, I can tell them where they're at.
You got a good idea where they're at. That's a good one. I like that.
It's kind of a fun game, really. But anyways, I would say as far as those top producing guys and what they're doing, as far as what they've told me, they've had a laser focus on productivity and efficiency and trying to be, and I would say some of that up here especially is a geographical thing as well, because if you're not super productive and efficient with your tillage pests, you might not have time to get everything done. I think farms are running more and more acres, is just a general, almost like a stereotype. Farms is a saying, you know, if you're not getting bigger, you're getting smaller. Not saying that, you know, I think our farm is kind of getting smaller, but it's still,
right. No,
I still
it.
Like it.
Yeah.
So if you're not efficient and you can't be extremely productive, you might not get your tillage pass done. And up here, no tillage, you know, a bad tillage job. The saying is bad tillage is worse than no tillage. So at least the guys in those conventional, you know, tillage practices, that's what they say. So that's where we've got a mix of guys that are, you know, they're not ripping all their, you know, corn in the fall. They might be doing maybe a third of it with the ripper and being on a 3-year cycle with a ripper and then running maybe a high speed disc or a 2660 VT, something like that in tandem with it, to make sure they get those acres done. They're as productive as possible. And if you look at like a 2730 ripper versus a 2680H or 2660 VT, the 2730, that's a more arduous tillage pass. So it's going to be a little bit slower.
Right.
If you talk about productivity, it's a little bit less productive than a high speed disc. I mean, when you do two of those in the same field and you watch how much ground you're covering with each one of them, you're like, holy cow.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. Another last quote just kind of popped in my head. Are we team tracks or LSWs?
Let's see. The royal we is in me. I've definitely always been partial to tracks, and it may be just that I think they look cooler. I mean, that's always part of it. It's like my golf game. I buy new golf clubs because they look cool, not because I'm going to hit it farther. Right.
There you go.
But I think actually with tracks, just that level of flotation. And I think the ride quality is unbelievable. And this transfers into tillage as well. Tire technology has come a long way in a short amount of time. You know, when you're talking LSWs on tractors, stuff like that, I mean, it's been within the last 5-6 years that LSW has gone from not existing to being kind of the go-to for tire guys. So it's, you know, 10 years ago, guys were running triples, you know, pretty commonly in my area, and you don't see that a lot anymore. So I think tire technology's come a long way. I wouldn't necessarily say one guy needs to do one over the other. but riding in a track machine, it's a good ride. And I know the benefits are there from a flotation standpoint.
Nice. Well, the way we try to end every one of our episodes, Sam, is to do a summary. So a little bit different format this week for our listeners. So I'll try to summarize both the planning topic and the tillage. And then while we're doing that, Dave's going to come up with a challenge for us. So we tried to put together an episode today for you guys, your listeners, and Sam, to get you thinking about the future of technology in and around spring preparation. So the first time we talked with Adam and we talked about planting with Adam with HTS Ag. So first thing, if you're not going to upgrade planters, not going to upgrade things, check out those bushings and parallel arms, and then maybe pay really good attention to the quality of downforce that you have. If you want to go high speed, he says that's the first thing that is important to go along with this, is making sure that you've got hydraulic downforce. So that way we make sure we get that even ride. High speed is here, and it sounds like it's that in both tillage and in planting. The faster that we can go, the more efficient we can be. But in planting, we might be upgrading to high speed for more reasons than just going fast. We're getting better seed depth and seed spacing, which is showing to have a positive ROI on your farm. Then after we have all this technology on our planter, we do have mobile and digital and remote options for service. With that, we moved right into the tillage side. We talked with Sam here. A lot of advancements, again, in the speed side. Everything has the recommended use of speed double digit, or has double digit range. On the speed side, we have the ability to adjust down to less than a tenth of an inch. And what I thought was kind of neat is we can actually write prescriptions for our tillage tool, which then again, making sure we can put the best ROI on each field that we possibly can. We don't know where the future is going. Is it autonomy? Maybe it's not. Maybe it's just continued automation. But where we're headed, that'll be a lot of fun for all of us to see.
I think it's interesting. There's a synergy between the planting and the tillage. And even though one might be prescription and the other less prescription, they're both relying on the same prescription, tell you the truth. The soil and the soil health is going to make a world of difference when we're talking about making more bushels per acre. So that's my challenge for the day, is actually knowing what you're good at. Know what you're good at, and if you're not good at it, make sure you hire that trusted advisor. So we've had a lot of people, Tanner, that have always said, what's the number one thing that they find in all successful people? And it's they're always challenging the process and always trying new things. I'm going to throw that out as a challenge this week to make sure that you're not just blowing it off. You're saying, we've always done it this way. I think the always done it this way doesn't work anymore. I think you better be listening, and because when it comes down to the margin of 10 extra bushels an acre, it might be that planter. It might be high speed. It might be tracks. It might be LSTA. It might be something as easy as a new piece of tillage equipment and a different speed than you were thinking. So I'm going to challenge everybody to make sure that they're reevaluating their operation all the time and know what they're good at and hire out the rest.
I like that. And even if they're not green, Sam, I think you would agree is, if you have a question or want to see a demo, just reach out and ask. Just get out there and see what actually is going on, because you don't know what you're missing out on until you learn about it.
Yeah, and I think, man, the reach that social media has had in the past, 5 or 6 months, where I've been able to talk to guys that are in Washington, New York, the Midwest, and areas that I don't cover, and they can ask me questions about stuff. I think that's so cool, because they rely on me, and they assume that I know what I'm talking about. So as long as I can come off as a guy that is generally likable and seems to know what he's doing, people reach out and ask for some advice on tillage equipment. So it's been a pretty cool experiment so far.
I think that's the same thing, is we get a lot of people reaching out to us as well, just because they assume we know. But that's the reason we have our experts like you on the phone. And thank you, Sam, for joining us. We really do appreciate that. Listener, we thank you for sticking around through the end of this. Remember, if you go out to the website and you click on that link to get to the BW Fusion website, you can learn more about how they work with you to boost those microbials in your soil. So we've got the seed bed aligned up exactly the way we want to. We got our planter set up exactly the way we want to. But unless we have that soil profile taken care of, we're not going to get to that maximum yield. So thank you again, listener, for joining in. Don't forget to like, rate, review, and share. And be sure to tune in next time.
Remember, if you aren't farming for profit, you won't be farming for long.